Coming up on show 1118, we're going to learn something today. A Saturday special interview with Graham Cooper from the National Grid. Stick around. Well, Graham's the head of future markets at National Grid. He's leading the drive to net zero 2050. Today we're going to talk about how to bring electric vehicles into the mainstream, how to electrify transport, and the role of hydrogen. Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, wherever you're listening around the world. Welcome to EV News Daily. It's a Saturday special interview. My name is Marcin Lee, and thank you for tuning in today as we talk to Graham, who is one of the key players in the net zero world, the decarbonisation world, electric vehicles world, of course. We're going to talk today about what the National Grid is, how electric vehicles can support the grid and demystify some of that ridiculous headline grabbing that the newspapers do. You know, when we all have electric vehicles, the grid will melt. No, it won't. Looking at how road, rail, aviation, and marine power can decarbonize. Looking at grid resilience, net zero 2050, and even a few tips on how to upgrade your home to make it more efficient. And we'll also talk about some hydrogen as well, because I've not been backwards in coming forwards about my distaste for hydrogen in terms of personal transport. I don't want to go back to a model of going to a certain filling station where somebody else dictates the price. I like the idea of solar panels, electric tariffs that I can often fix for a year or more at a time, and electricity is cheaper. But he makes a very, very good case for how hydrogen will be part of the mix. And also, he is so on the money in terms of detribalizing, not a word, the current community around electric vehicles, hydrogen transport, and some of what we need to be doing in the future. So enjoy this one. I really enjoyed it. It runs almost getting towards an hour long. Graham is one of those rare people that you meet in life who is a super brain. In fact, he's got, I think, several brains going at once, but has this ability to talk and communicate and explain in a way that isn't patronizing, but does explain things in a very simple way, what is, and many times, really complex subjects. Like I say, it's a recording of a live stream from a few days ago, so I was still pretty poorly at the time when we recorded this. So anyway, enjoy the interview, and I'll be back at the end.
Hi, thanks very much. I'm honoured to be counted as influential, because I was worried that you were getting me to stand in because someone didn't turn up. But thank you.
Well, we had to pick the most important people that we thought would add the most commitment to what's happening in the EV industry. It's a fast moving industry, and obviously at the National Grid, that's what you are. To anyone listening to Martin's podcast, you're going to hear a lot more of me today. As Martin's podcast listeners are probably aware, he's not got much of a voice at the moment. Graham, why don't you start us off with the National Grid? Are you the people that have that control room? Who are you? Where do you work? Because it's a really complicated structure.
Yeah, you try working in the complicated structure. No, I'll try and make this really simple, right? So in the UK, National Grid is a price-regulated monopoly for both the gas and electricity transmission system. So in road terms, electrically, we are the motorways and dual carriageways of the electrical system in England and Wales. And in gas terms, we're the motorways and dual carriageways in England, Wales, and Scotland. So I work for National Grid Electricity Transmission. We're part of a group of businesses. So 6 minutes drive this way is the control room. So that's National Grid ESO, Electricity System Operator. Now, they're the really brainy people who make the real-time supply and demand. They balance the grid. They're the people who have the big space screen. You know, you see them phoning up and getting wind turbines to start and stop and nuclear power stations on and off. They're the guys who do the future energy scenarios, you know, that forecasting of what the grid might look like. Really clever bunch of people. That's that bit of National Grid. But I work for the bit that has to make sure the right wires are in the right place at the right time to enable the transition. And that works for gas pipes as well as wires. The other bits of National Grid, just so that we're really clear, we've got a bit National Grid called National Grid Ventures. What do? They do all sorts of things like build, own, and operate things like interconnectors in the UK. Crikey, we have a metering business. We have a company called National Grid Partners that is an investor business in startups and scale-ups. But I mean, principally for the bulk of your listeners, we own the pipes and wires. But the things we don't do, right, because this is a bit where often people get confused, right? We don't make electricity or gas. We don't buy electricity or gas. We don't sell electricity or gas. We are the conduit from where it is made to where it needs to get to. So my customers typically would be a power station, steelworks, even the regional distribution companies. That's National Grid, as concise as I can get it.
Are you sat at the top of the group? Is that right? So you're National Group, you have the other groups underneath you? Is that the way it should?
No, it's really complicated. No, so we've just been through a reorganization. We've got a bunch of silos. So we have National Grid Group, the bit that is the investment vehicle, the bit that owns the money, that has the profits. You know, John Pettigrew is our chief executive of the business. And then all the other businesses are silos that sit underneath it. So I guess, like all those things, we're children of National Grid Group, and National Grid Group loves us all the same, but we're all okay. Very, very different. All right.
Yeah. And it's structured that way, if I remember rightly, because effectively you are a monopoly here in the UK, and therefore it's structured this way. Yes. So each one can't influence each other.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, historically, if we look back, right, let's go back to about 1980. We were the CEGB, Central Electricity Generating Board. We owned we were a government business. We had power stations and wires, and it was, everything was the CEGB, right? Margaret Thatcher came along and said, let's privatize and drive competition. So, of course, if you own all the wires, you are then naturally a monopoly. So what happened April 2 years ago is Ofgem thought it was a really good idea that the bit that controls the wires ought to be legally separate from the bit that owns the wires, right? And that way it's clearer and more transparent. We found 2 years ago in April that National Grid ESO, Electricity System Operator, became a legally separate business. So it's still owned by National Grid Group at the top, but they're strangers to me and I'm strangers to them. And if I want to talk to them, I need to book a meeting just like any other customer of them. So you know, it's different offices, different passwords, different passes. For all intents and purposes, we're different businesses.
Can I ask in terms of, let's start with, because we're going to get into some really interesting stuff this evening, because one of the things that I find is that people get into electric vehicles, learn what a kilowatt hour is, not just me, and then get really interested in all of this kind of stuff. But let's start with, electric vehicles are going to take down the grid. Now, we read a lot about things like power walls and home energy storage. And one of the headlines reasons to buy these products is always like, oh, when there's a power cut, you stay online. And I'm not doing down, of course, what we've seen in Texas over the last few months and around the world, various places. But I live in Poole and I can't think of the last time I got home and the oven clock was flashing because I'd missed a power cut. We just don't get power cuts. We take it for granted so much that the grid just works. So let's talk about how the grid works now with a few EVs around, and what's it going to be like when we're all driving EVs?
So look, really, really simply, I can give you even the number. So as a licensed monopoly, our reliability is 99.99987. So if you work that out mathematically, if I think I've got that right, I think we would have a bad day if it was 7 seconds in a year, right? The DNOs, you know, the regional power companies, have a slightly lesser standard, but again, still, I think for them, it's 7 minutes a year is their standard, somewhere along those lines. So on your energy bill, you know, that standing charge on your energy bill, you know, that 19 pence a day or whatever it is, that's paying for the grid, right? And you're getting one of the most reliable grids in the world. So I think it's not bad value. I know I work for a network, but I'm a bill payer as well, but, you know, that's not bad. So, but what's changing? So a lot of people think about when they say, well, will the grid melt or will the grid cope? I think they're confusing two things potentially, right? The first one is, where is the energy coming from? And will there be enough? So that's one point. We'll pick that in a second. The other one is, will the wires be thick enough and in the right place to carry that power? So let's pick those apart in two ways. So crikey, the dirtiest thing we did as a country until 2017 was make electricity, right? We had principally a gas and coal-fired energy system. In the last 15 years, we've built a lot of wind farms and there's a lot of solar. I mean, I spent 11 years building £500 million of the wind farms, right? So I've been a wind farmer, so I know how this stuff works. And the grid has changed to suit that changing market. So in the same way, you know, that's sort of happened over time. And in the same way, the transition to cleaning transport, and we'll use cars as transport for now, but this is bigger than just cars, is just a transition. You know, it's like that, oh, well, if everybody just switched on, plugged in a car at the same time and charged, is there enough power? We work on the basis of diversity, right? Not everybody does everything at the same time, right? So, you know, it's an engineering principle that goes into these things. But let's just pick up kind of, you know, that sort of energy component. So don't forget, the dirty thing we do now is move people and goods. It was making energy. So now we've got more variable energy systems there. And what we've had is a system where the control room is asking power stations to turn up or to turn down to meet demand. Because we didn't have smart meters, we didn't have fancy tariffs. You just use energy when you use energy, right? So that's generally pick up in the morning for breakfast. The grid is uses less energy in the middle of the day, and it picks up for your evening meal. So we're roughly peak demand, you know, for a summer's day right now, right? Because people are at home watching TV and cooking their dinner. But what we have when as we move towards electric vehicles and, you know, heat pumps and those sort of things is we now have demand side management. So instead of just turning power stations up or down, you could turn demand up or down as well. So you're into a situation now where actually you can cut the tops off the peak and put them in a trough. I mean, I'm already using an app, right, that stops my car charging when the grid is, you know, dirty and expensive. You know, I'm a bit tight. I say don't charge it if it's any more than 8p, and don't fill the car with energy when it's more than 90 grams of CO2 a kilowatt hour. Right. So, you know, the technology is already there. So crikey. I mean, it's one of those things. Do we have enough generation to cope with everything going electric? Well, yes, we'd have to do smart charging, but that's now. Now, can I add to that on where the energy comes from? The other half of my job is trying to ensure that we've got the right wires to accommodate 30 gigawatts more of offshore wind. So in Boris's 10-point plan, he said we're going to be Saudi Arabia of Europe. Yeah, in offshore wind terms, I think was the term he used. So we're going to be, it's taken us 20 years to get to 10 gigawatts, and we're going to get to 40 gigawatts, so an additional 30 in the next 9 years. So even if you wouldn't ring fence the energy, but in broad terms, if you ring fence that energy, you know, the amount of energy that those wind farms would generate, you pretty much cover the same amount of energy as electrifying road transport. And we're going to get that much energy on the system in the next 8 or 9 years. How long is it going to take us to get everything on the roads electric? So that's the energy bit. The wires bit is the grid morphs, right? It changes. We've built wires into the wilds of Scotland, or the Scottish TOs have the wilds of Scotland, right, to connect wind farms. In the same way, we've seen governments Project Rapid, which will build bigger grid connections on the motorway network because there'll be a focused demand. So, you know, if you said, would it all work if overnight a magic fairy took away all the petrol cars and gave us all electric cars and we all charged simultaneously? It's completely implausible and there might be an issue. But this is a managed transition. And when people say, oh, well, you don't know what you're talking about. No, it's going to be fine, right?
So what you're saying is we're going to have plenty of power for electric cars. But you've just brought up a big issue there, which I've noticed, which is you're going to have all this wind. So are we going to have a problem where we're going to have too much power on the grid and not enough times to consume it? Do you reckon electric cars might even be the solution?
Yes, absolutely. So this is where this gets really, really smart. So for those of you, I mean, I think, Martin, you've done a podcast, and I know, Nick, you guys talk about the Octopus Agile, right? So a really visible way of the energy reflecting what the consumer pays against the market price, okay? So we've seen higher highs with more renewables, but we've also seen lower lows and negative pricing. So when people say, well, the grid won't cope, EVs are theoretically a problem for grid networks, but they also bring the solution with them. So what will happen when we have that much more wind on the system is the control room could then make two choices. Does it curtail generation and say, turn down, and we pay you to do that? Or does it say, turn up demand? So a signal will go out to switch on car chargers and to switch on heat pumps to fill water tanks and fill batteries. So actually, as much as it could be a problem, it brings its own solution with it.
Okay. Is this to a degree about perception as well? Let me explain what I mean by that. I was broadcasting back in September 2000 when for those that remember the fuel protests. And, you know, when you see a queue at a petrol station, you panic and you think, I'm not going to be able to get to work tomorrow, take the kids to school, do my jobs. Equally, COVID rewinds 12 months and my goodness, let's not mention toilet paper. So is part of the job of you grid providers, regulators, governments, is part of the job saying everything is going to be okay? Because if people behave irrationally, they cause you more problems. And that links in with a question that we had from Kyle a moment ago, which you kind of half answered. He's someone I do a video podcast with on Fridays, Kyle Connor, okay, from Out of Spec Motoring. And he was saying, well, how do you encourage and how do you get people to change their habits? Don't like being told what to do. If you tell people you can't charge right now, then people are going to just panic and think, well, I want to charge right now. I need to go buy some toilet paper.
No.
Psychology as well?
No. Okay. No. So let's try and paint a more interesting picture. So, right, you come home from work, you plug the car in, and you only care when you get up at 7 a.m. and get in the car to go to work, right? So you could have 7, 10, 12 hours of the car stationary. Do you really care when it charges? Probably not, right? So in that period of time, the grid will be dirtier when you're eating your dinner, and it'll be very clean at 2 or 3 a.m. So if someone said to you, you can charge it at peak time, and that's going to cost you, well, what's the peak rate on Octopus Agile? 35p a unit. That's an expensive kilowatt hour, right? Or actually, in the wee small hours, it is really windy and really low demand. We'd pay you to put electrons in your car. You're going to say, right, use my app, do that, make the magic work, right? So where I think this is going is this is why, for the grant-funded charges that you get from OLEV, OZEV now, they have to be smart, right? And no one's actually said yet who controls the smart. But what I think you'll also see, because I sit on the government's EV Energy Task Force, and one of the recommendations is that all chargers should be smart, yeah? So what I suspect you'll see is probably back end of the year is, irrespective of whether they're grant funded or not, they'll need to be smart. So you're kind of building that sort of mentality in. You'll probably find, and again, it's not for me to decide, but these things will normally be shipped smart enabled, right? So they just do smart from the minute they're wired up. So it's then a case of, it's an opt-out. So if you say, I don't want Big Brother controlling my car charging, you'll be able to get round the smart charging. But there'll be a consequence. And that will be, you can charge when you like, but it's going to cost you 8 times, 10 times, 3 times, whatever that is, to do that. And in the same way, if you kind of came home and you went, I've got to rush Auntie to the hospital in an hour's time, you'll be able to press an override button. And it will be, yes, you'll pay a little bit more for it, but it's not Big Brother controlling it. Because don't forget, the cost of the energy system falls onto bill payers. So if you're always building, if you assume that there's no smart and you're driving everyone to charge at peak time, we will just build a bigger grid system of which every bill payer shares the cost. So do you want us to future-proof gold plates, double the size of, just in case everybody just wants to override? Or do you actually want to do this a little bit smart? The best way I liken it to is budget airlines. You kind of do the book early, and I get a flight for 19 quid. I want to fly tomorrow, and it's the north end of 200 quid, right? So we understand the value of something over time. Energy is no, electrical energy is no different.
Right. What Kyle said in the chat there, he also said America, for example, they don't like being told what to do. But
yep.
National Grid also have a side of business over in America as well, don't you? So what are you finding from your American colleagues? Are America ahead of us, behind us, same pace as us?
So us Brits look at America and we go, it's one place. No. The United States of America is like 52 different countries that do their own thing, right? Because a lot of stuff is done at state level. So the thing is, if I say, well, America is 7 years behind, you'll go, oh, hang on, California, they're way ahead of us. Right, so there's not a one-size-fits-all. In the jurisdictions where we operate in the US, we run a slightly different business. We're more like a DNO. We're doing more of the stuff in the street rather than transmission, which is what we do in the UK. In the US, the sort of work we do there is we're just doing make ready. So we're putting ducts in the ground ready for someone to do charging, right? Rather than doing charging. At the moment, there's a lot of debate around time of use tariffs, but they don't really do that yet. So what I generally find from my US colleagues is they generally ask questions around what we're seeing across Europe, because Europe is seen as being the broadly a leader in this space. I mean, they look to California, but they look to Europe as well. And they're 3-4 years, maybe 5 years behind where we are on the journey, for want of a better word. But at the same time, it's really difficult to generalize, you know, because as I say, you could look at California and go, well, hang on, they're almost like Norway, right? Way ahead. So it's just too difficult to generalize.
Okay. And then also in your business, you were talking before how you're in charge of doing wind and stuff like that, but you've also, the National Grid also looks at the way of your vehicle, your actual job title now is future of transport, sort of the
future market.
Energy market,
that's everything.
Future market,
I mean, that's
everything. Yeah. So you're looking at planes?
Yep. Buses? So from a transport perspective, my standard trot out is road, rail, aviation and maritime.
Okay.
So, I mean, even on planes, right? So if you 80% of the emissions in aviation come from just 20% of the flights, right? And that's long haul. And you can fix the short haul stuff by batteries or hydrogen or supercapacitors, but the long haul stuff, you'll never get, there's nothing as energy dense as Jet A1, right? So how do we still have that once a year trip to somewhere exotic, right? And that's where things like synthetic Jet A1 will come in, or some people call them e-fuels, synthetic Jet A1. But of course, it's really energy intensive to make it, which means it is doable, but it's going to be more expensive. So, you know, but yes, and where does the energy come from making those e-fuels? So we can cover anything as far as transport. If it moves, I have an interest, probably not down at an e-scooter level, but if it moves, I've got an interest in it.
Let's just talk a little bit about resilience in the grid as well, in terms of how we, you know, all share power. And I saw a tweet earlier this week from Adam Tooze talking about a new underground cable between the UK and Norway, and that's going to be 1-point-something megawatts. He doesn't say in his tweet, but or maybe he does. So just talk to us about how, you know, we are a small island, as it were, but we're not on our own. Obviously, there's a political side of leaving the EU, and of course not, we are European still. So how does that work in terms of keeping the lights on?
So, right. Okay. In broad terms, the UK is a net importer of energy. We roughly import, I think, about 7%, right, of our energy. But in a world where we have much more renewables, you know, much more offshore wind, the ability to, when we've got too much, send it to somewhere else, but also the safety net that when we don't have enough to pull it in, that's why you need interconnectors. So Ofgem have been stimulating the market to have interconnectors, and you can see them on the tweet there. Why is Norway really interesting from this perspective? So Norway is a really energy literate country. I actually did my MBA at a Norwegian university because they're so energy literate, right? They've got all of this oil and they hardly use any of it, right? So Norway is roughly 98% hydro, right? So they see storage, not as a Tesla Powerwall, they see snow. And then the snow melts and it fills up the dams, and then the dams flow and it generates their electricity. So they have very, 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 very cheap electricity. But in energy terms, it also means they look like a battery, right? So if you project forward, when Norway's running very, very cheap energy, they have a surplus and we're short, the power will flow from Norway to Scotland, you know, and into the grid. So cheap and clean coming our way. But then turn that on its head. If we have a very low demand but high wind day, lots of wind generation, the price falls, we'll be cheaper than Norway. So naturally, the energy will flow back to Norway. So, and don't forget, Norway's not an islanded nation. It's connected to Sweden. It's, you know, I mean, one thing that often people say in the whole debate about Europe is it was the UK that drove so much of the regulation and environmental legislation and grid operation across Europe, right? Until the UK separated everything out, you know, generation from transmission, from distribution, from retail, we pushed that through Europe. And that's how the European energy system works now. So we've actually been the crafter of the way the energy system works across Europe, as opposed to just being given it. But yeah, the interconnectors will be really important. Sometimes we're even a transit country. So there's websites where you can look at power flows. And sometimes power comes in the bottom, it goes through the grid and pops out the top. Sometimes it pops in at the top, comes through and drops out the bottom. So if you're looking at the interconnection between, so BritNed and IFA2, so sometimes we see power flows coming from the Netherlands through the UK and down to France rather than going through Belgium. Go figure. So interconnectors are really, really important. On the journey to net zero, they just give us lots of flexibility and the ability to sell power out of the country, but also buy it in.
Okay, so that in turn means that people in Britain pay slightly less for the electricity than they would if we were just a single island nation, not exporting or importing anywhere else.
Well, if we didn't import it, we'd have to build more generation. So yeah, I mean, it's a whole system. It's that whole system thinking, right? You know, share resources, right? And you could look across Europe as well. You've got different, I mean, France is principally nuclear, so very, very clean at the point of consumption, right? And then you see Poland and they're a lot of coal. They're coming off coal, but very dirty grid. So, you know, countries can learn, trade energy, go with the cheapest and cleanest, and it sort of works and it's evolving, right? I mean, there's no rule book for cleaning a grid and getting to net zero. So we're all working our way through all of these changes to make sure that it works. But it is working.
Seeing you've touched on net zero, it'd be nice to move and segue over to that. So net zero for the UK, national. So we're talking national grid, as in the people who turn the lights off and on. They have a net zero target of 2030. Is that right?
2020. So the stuff in the media is, so let's try and be really clear. This is, I'll try and make it simple. It's complicated in my head, but I'll try and make it simple. So can I go backwards before I go forwards?
Of course.
12 years ago, when I connected my first transmission connected wind farm, I sat down in the control room at National Grid and I said, oh, you're really big and scary and I'm a little wind farmer and I've just built my first transmission connected wind farm and I need to be controlled by you. How does that work? And I was sat down and they said, well, this is how it works. And you know, renewables aren't really big, they aren't really important, and you can't really run a grid with more than 4% variable or intermittent generation on it, and that's how that works. So don't worry your pretty little self about it. Please shut the door on your way out. And if you look at the moment, we're running the country, or today we've been running the country, I think about 50 or 60% on renewables. So it shows you that there's been a lot of learning in that process, right? So in a world that where the control room 10 or 15 years ago thought the grid would break if we had more than 4% renewables on, it's really clever that they are now in a position where they've said in 2025, they will be able to run the grid net zero for a period of time. Now, I'm choosing my words very carefully here because they're their words, not my words. So this is not the grid runs clean 24 hours a day, 365, but they're being able to demonstrate that the grid can be run net zero and the lights stay on. And that's really, really important. Now, you know, there will be times when there's more wind or less wind, more solar, less solar, more demand, right? So it's the learning by doing. And the thing that's impressive is the fact that they can do it. It won't be running clean 24 hours a day. It's building blocks, right? It'll be run it for half an hour, learn, right? And then they'll do it again and they'll run it for an hour and learn. And it's all about keeping the system stable, right? Resilient, because none of us want to be sat in the dark. So that's why you see them saying that they can run the system net zero in 2025. It won't be running it all clean all of the time. But it's the ability to do it for a bit and learn. National Grid as a business will be net zero by 2050. Our fleet will be alternatively fueled by 2030. I mean, there are lots of dates in there, but I mean, effectively, Nick, we're not the people who make us net zero, but we are the critical enabler, right? So more clean stuff, providing clean renewable power, more clean consumption downstream, you know, cars and heat pumps and what have you. We're the important bit in the middle. So we're a critical enabler, but it's not us making the country net zero. but we're certainly there to help.
What's the balance in terms of, you know, the word market is literally in your job title. What is the balance between letting the market decide everything? And that's the, you know, that's the capitalist bit of me coming out, being like, don't worry, just price the electricity different times of the day. People care about the pound in their pocket. Don't worry about it. It's like it, the market will fix it, versus regulation and having a clear set of regulations and a clear, well, you know, Euros are on at the moment, just a clear goal to shoot the ball at, because I don't know. If, you know, the politicians have talked about this and you know, then not always clear on what's an EV versus a plug-in versus a hybrid versus, but anyway, so, but that's not the point of my question, but like, what's the balance at the moment and will it change over time? And, you know, what's the official line versus maybe some of the various points of view on this subject?
So Martin, Nick promised me you'd ask me easy questions. This one goes definitely into the difficult part.
We've got 15 minutes left.
So very simply, the energy market is a market, right? So the capitalist bit of you is there, right? You know, energy is generated. There are power purchase agreements to the suppliers who put the energy into your home, right? But what government is doing is they believe that markets will fix everything eventually. So that's the capitalist piece is absolutely there. But then you've got externalities, right? So the externality of energy is we've now got time and climate. Yeah, net zero 2050. So that's not a market-based, do you know what I mean? So there's an element of intervention, but there's intervention where it won't get fixed solely by markets in the time needed, which is why, although coal is dying out naturally on our system anyway, they've mandated to end coal by 2025. So you put a legislative backstop, but coal has gone because there's, you know, the market for coal generation has sort of gone anyway. So in the same way, I mean, let's use that as another example, right? EVs and the ban on the sale of combustion engine cars in 2030. Are you really going to rock up to a dealer, right, last week of December in 2029 and say, sell me a diesel Volkswagen Golf, right? One, will they actually still make them, you know? And, you know, you're likely to find people, you signal, and then people make other decisions based on a signal, which is why you don't get so micro-interventionist by government. They give you the big policy steer, right? And then leave the market to fix. Does that help? We could spend 2 hours on this anyway.
No, it really does, because there's things that fascinate me. Like, you know, our energy consumption has reduced significantly over the last 8 to 10 years. And then I read, well, we're all using LED light bulbs in our house now. And it, you know, I remember putting those in years ago, and it was the early ones were pretty terrible. These ones have been, you know, they'll go on for donkey's years. And so it's so small. I mean, they were really expensive as well, but they're really cheap now. But it's like, really, changing our light bulbs, can that massively take gigawatts off a system? But it seems to have done.
Like, singularly, the biggest. Well, this is why. So the whole debate on climate change is, if we all do a bit, right, we don't need to all go back to living in caves. This is kind of the point that, have you ever heard Chris Stark from the Committee on Climate Change? The journey to net zero doesn't mean we're all going to be in loincloths living in caves, right? Because when you look at the transition, if everybody does a bit, it's amazing how much you move the dial. And your example of light bulbs, look, we all have light, right? We can all still work, and we've saved a ton of money and a ton of carbon by doing it. So, you know, you can show that this is possible. In the same way with transport decarbonization, we don't actually care. The need is to get from somewhere to somewhere else, right? How you get there is the nudge, right? So by going to EV, we'll save a ton of carbon and a ton of energy in doing that. But the legislative nudge is that, well, we were hoping that people would go there more naturally, so we put a legislative lever in. It then becomes a normalization, and then people will move that way anyway. So that's where that sort of interventionist and market plays a role with each other. But if we all do a bit, it's amazing how much you can change.
And so what can we do then? So you're an EV driver. How do you sort of heat and power your home, for instance?
I'll do the whole thing, right? This is a 600-ish year old house. I bought it derelict 10 years ago.
Wow.
And when I arrived, I lived in a caravan I bought off eBay in the garden for the first year, right? So yeah, when people say, oh, you just throw money at a problem. No, this is 10 years of weekends and evenings. But when I rocked up, I couldn't really afford the house. I couldn't really afford to renovate it. And I scared myself. I said, I got an energy assessor in, and he basically said, your house has the same thermal performance as a marquee, Mr. Cooper. And you're going to go, okay, so tell me what this looks like. He said, well, the only way to heat this is oil. I said, okay, tell me the bad news. He said, it's going to cost you £5,500 in oil to heat your home. And I said, okay, so how big's the tank going to need to be? He said, well, it's going to be about the size of a transit van. And I'm thinking, transit van, oil, £5,500. Don't like the sound of any of those things. So just ask all the daft questions. So where are we fast forward to now? I have a three-phase supply to the house. I have 28 kilowatts of ground source heat pumps. I have two heat pumps. They're ground source. I've got 2 kilometers of loops in the garden, spirals. I have economy 10 because I don't have a smart three-phase meter yet. I'm on the list for a smart three-phase meter, so economy 10. I'm on Octopus Energy, so I'm getting clean energy. I've got an electric car, a plug-in hybrid, and I even treat all my own wastewater, so the only emission from my home is clean water, right? So I'm all in. I'm paid to do this as a job. I do it at home. So effectively, my home is effectively carbon neutral. To be fair, if you ever come visit, and you're welcome, I do have a log burner. We have been known to put a log on Christmas morning just for effect, right? So shoot me now. But other than that, we're a pretty clean house.
And is that that's achievable to the rest of us in terms of we're increasingly reading about heat pumps, but there's a bit of a kind of a dark art, really.
Oh, well, no. So it's a couple of things. Firstly, in the next 2 weeks, I would hazard a guess that you're going to see the heat in building strategy from government, right? And they're going to talk a lot about heat pumps, right? They'll talk a little bit about hydrogen boilers, but they're going to talk a lot about heat pumps. But heat pumps, we have a heat pump in all of our homes. Whether you know it or not, it's a fridge, right? My heat pumps are a fridge in reverse. It pushes out really cold water in the loop. If you actually, next time, pull your fridge forward, reach around the back, cold on the inside, warm on the back, you're reversing it, right? That's what a heat pump does. So very few moving parts. And this has been around for 20, 30 years. So it should be possible. It should be possible. You need to do some good insulation because it's a lower grade heat. The water out of your boiler is 65 degrees. The water out of my heat pump is 55 degrees. So, there's a small difference. It doesn't act quite as fast, but it's all doable.
So now we've mentioned that obviously we're banning gas, and I don't know.
Who's banning? Hang on!
Well, banning gas boilers. Is that right?
Oh God! To be fair, right? So the legislation says no new gas connections for new build properties. I think it's 2025.
Right.
And in the heat strategy that we may or may not see from government in the next couple of weeks, they will probably say something about the end of gas boilers at some point in time.
Okay.
So you're right in a fashion.
Yeah. All I mean is no new gas boilers. So, I mean, I looked at National Grid today's stock, and in the news I found that National Grid is selling off their gas business shortly. So I presume that means that you're now, as a National Grid group, concentrating more on looking towards more power supply for heat pump systems like this. What about hydrogen heating? Are we seeing, because I've titled the video grid to net zero and we're going to need hydrogen. So is the hydrogen going to be there for heating, or is it going to be there for another source? And do you want to explain to people why we actually do need hydrogen for 2050?
Right, let's go really simple, right? If you read it, I'm not saying that you should read cover to cover the net zero report by the Committee on Climate Change, but if you're sad enough like me and read it cover to cover, when we had our target of 80% reduction by 2050, which was the original climate target, you could have argued you might just have got there with electricity alone, right? Because all you'd do is the dirtiest stuff would be your remaining 20%. But in a world where we have to get to net zero, we cannot get to net zero without hydrogen, right? It is not possible, right? So if you, so that first means that there, you have to stop the tribalism between electrify everything and hydrogen, right? The answer is it has to be there. So it's then a case of where, what sort of hydrogen, where does it come from, and how do you best use it? So, crikey, where do we want to start? Right, so at the moment, 95% of commercial hydrogen in the market is comes as a byproduct of the oil and gas industry, right? So it's dirty. So one way of looking at it is you do carbon capture, usage and storage. So you strip the hydrogen out of it, you capture the carbon, you pump it out under the North Sea and put it in the empty space where you've taken the oil out. That's one option. It's expensive to do. It's going to happen. We're going to see a hydrogen strategy this side of government recess on the 22nd of July. We're likely to see the government's hydrogen strategy. But for CCUS to work, you need a strong demand for hydrogen. You need a big enough plant to capture the carbon. You need to build a pipe to send it out. You know, it's a big step. The other way of making hydrogen at the moment is about 5%. It's through electrolysis. So you pass a current through water, you know, H2O. You take the H2 out of H2O, right? But that needs electricity. And if you use green electricity, you know, clean electricity, then it's green hydrogen. If you are using hydrogen that's had the carbon taken out of it, it's blue hydrogen. But what we see is, crikey, let's try and pick this up in bite-sized chunks. As a country, because of the relative efficiency of making hydrogen, we should electrify everything that's easy to electrify, which is why, for want of an argument, you see electric cars winning, right? It's a product that's there, it's very efficient, it works. Nick's got a lovely picture of a hydrogen car. It's taken me 3 years to get a test drive in a hydrogen car. And what do I find? National Grid has got two of these bad boys. Because the whole idea to do is learn by doing, right? So we've actually leased two hydrogen cars to understand, right? Because you can't tell unless you understand, right? So why are you only seeing these rare beasties on the road? Because kind of in EVs or in cars, electrification is one. Where should we be using the hydrogen? We should be using the hydrogen on the difficult to electrify stuff, big industrial processes, really heavy plants, really heavy trucks, you know, freight trains, right? The stuff that really needs, that's very difficult to electrify. Coming back to your point around how are we going to heat our homes? Some heating, and again, I have to hypothesize a bit because I haven't seen the heating in building strategy, but getting a hydrogen ready boiler will become a thing. But I suspect a lot of the hydrogen readiness, at least for the next 10 or 15 years, could be locational. It's not about picking the winner. What we've got in the UK is a number of hydrogen hubs, you know, sort of Teesside, Humber, areas where you've got big industrial processes, but you've also got an oil and gas industry, for want of a, you know, better argument, yeah? So you're going to have hydrogen in the debate anyway, and you need hydrogen demand to warrant making CCUS hydrogen. So I would hazard a guess, and this is the Graham Cooper view of the world, not the National Grid view of the world, is you're very much more likely to see a higher chance of having hydrogen boilers near the hubs. And if you're not near a hub, you're probably much more likely to have a heat pump. Now, all bets are off, right? Because this is an emerging market. We're waiting for the heat strategy. But businesses like National Grid and the GDNs, the distribution companies for the gas business, are not sitting on their laurels here. They are actually blending in and trialing blending in 5% of hydrogen into the gas system, into natural gas. Then they're going to try and run it at 10%. They've actually built a row of houses and they're using old gas equipment to see how the gas behaves to actually stress test this and run it, right? Learn by doing. So, you know, the answer certainly isn't 100% heat pumps. But in the same way, the answer isn't 100% hydrogen boilers. The answer is both. In the same way, let's pick trucking, right? The whole debate on trucking is it battery or is it hydrogen? The answer is probably both. But really interestingly, both of those need a grid connection because you're going to make hydrogen where you use it for trucking and you're going to charge batteries where the trucks are, right? So the nice thing from a National Grid perspective is you need the right grid capacity in the right place for the right usage. Okay, so a long answer to a short question, but I hope that gives you a bit of a richness.
Yeah, so we can probably assume cars are probably just going to go full electric. We're not going to see a hydrogen crossover there. Probably, well, at least not in the UK.
So you've seen, so Jaguar Land Rover today have launched the Hydrogen Defender. I think that you will probably see, for, you know, people who do executive chauffeurs, people who want the, you know, want a fast refill and want bigger range. Yeah, maybe, but it will still be on the margins, right? Specialist equipment. We send people across fields to fix pylons and substations, right? So specialist equipment could well be, you know, a hydrogen for a car. So that's why it's never as binary as there's no one answer. There's no one silver bullet to the net zero question, right? In any of these answers. So it's the big question. It's the ability to have a mixture. Go on.
So the big question on net zero is, if we want to be net zero, if we want to be greener, more sustainable, we need to stop being tribal. It's only going to be EVs. It's only going to be electric this. It's only going to be electric ships. It's only going to be... We need to think more broadly. Do we care about the environment, or do we care about being an EV tribe?
Yeah, well, this is the thing I find really interesting, right? You're wasting energy, in the broadest sense, if you're fighting between two cleaner technologies. You should be fighting status quo, the dirty technology, right? That's a much more logical step to make. But I also think one of the things I want to bring in, Nick, is that the argument, and you know, I've driven a hydrogen car, it's all right. For me, electric's better for a car perspective, so that's my personal view. But when you start to think about it, people rubbish hydrogen because of its inefficiency. If you make hydrogen from electricity, it is inefficient. The round-trip efficiency is not great, right? But can I come back to one of my earlier comments? We're going to have 40 gigawatts of offshore wind arriving in the next 10 years, which means the relative efficiency may not be a feature at all when you have a high wind, low demand day. And what are you going to do? Once you've filled up all the car batteries and everyone's hot water tank with hot water, are you just going to pay wind to stop? Or are you going to make hydrogen? And then what you've done is you've deferred the energy that you've captured then for another time. So I fully agree, the round trip efficiency on hydrogen, if you're only looking at the lens of efficiency, you wouldn't do hydrogen. But the cold reality is we will have flexibility is going to be the newest commodity. So power walls, smart charging, the ability to shift energy vectors. And what hydrogen does is it creates an energy shift, a time shift, right? And therefore, the relative efficiency sort of goes out the window. And do you know where we've had this argument before on efficiency? When I was early in the wind, I built 8 large-scale wind farms, right? And the argument at planning permissions and what have you was, oh, they're only this efficient. Yes, but the wind is free. So the efficiency perspective is a moot point. In the same way, when we talk about the journey to you know, hydrogen, yes, the round-trip efficiency is not as good as just electrifying. But if you've got spare electricity, right, make hydrogen, right? Otherwise, you're wasting it, right? So, you know, I think like all these things, if you look just through the lens of transport or just through the lens of hydrogen, you need to have a very, very mixed view. Hmm. And I think really that's where National Grid has quite a unique view. Okay, because we're technology agnostic by our license. We are the enabler of the journey to net zero, right? So we're not picking winners. We're here to enable whatever is there to turn up, right?
Yeah, so I'm assuming it'll also be a lot cheaper to have hydrogen storage, if you like, batteries sites than having a load of lithium-ion batteries there. So if you could make hydrogen with that cheap wind energy and store it as hydrogen, and then use it later on, maybe to repower the grid again.
Do you know, there's a variety of things there, Nick. You could take hydrogen and use it to make ammonia, then it's a liquid. You could hydrogen and pump it into a gas grid, so that sort of gives you storage as well. You could pressurize it and keep it. I mean, the thing is, with flexibility, batteries are really, really good. You know, lithium-ion batteries are really, really good for short-term, you know, within day, within hour, within a couple of days storage, right? That's why we have things like pumped hydro. That's long duration. That's hours of energy flowing down a hill through a turbine. So in the world we're going into, flexibility is key. But we'll have a mixture of flexibility, interconnectors between us and another country. We're going to have flexibility in electricity into hydrogen. We will have electricity in battery storage, in water tanks. I mean, I've got 600 litres of hot water storage here, right? They're just a big thermal battery. My heat pump runs for 10 hours a day, or could run for 10 hours a day. But I go for a number of hours, you know, when we're at peak time, when my heat pump doesn't run, but I still warm and I still have hot water because I have a heat battery. So we need a variety of storage mediums for the journey to net zero. So that, again, there's no one silver bullet. It's not lithium ion. It's not just pump storage. It's not just hydrogen. We need a mixture of all of these things.
Well, so, I think
there you go.
What's been so interesting tonight is just to hear you in a way that I've understood tonight, explain that debate, because it's been so frustrating just to have somebody come on in a soundbite or I was gonna say Toyota press release, but there is a kind of ideological thing with the sort of Japanese, you know, but from, you know, they do their big hydrogen, so whether it's the government or the car makers or whatever, so, you know, and just in a sentence or two say hydrogen is the future, and so naturally, you know, you go, well, that's, no it's not, like, come on, don't be, I can't buy one of those cars, I can't fill up at the end of my road, it's a stupid thing to say. But actually, when I hear you talking about how it's not just transport, it's about storing, thinking about energy.
Man,
thank you so much for explaining it, because I just have much more of a nuanced view of it now, and I want to certainly learn some more. Certainly people can go onto the National Grid website, at least here in the UK, I'm sure, US as well, and there's a load of information on there, part of your blog and your articles, where people can learn more and look at kind of the work you're doing. So I really appreciate, you know, your time coming on, and I would consider myself moderately well read, but I clearly wasn't, because I understand it now.
That's fine. Look, I think the thing that's important is, in an internet world, we've developed this idea that I'm right, so you must be wrong, right? No. We sort of lost the ability to have a debate and a discussion. I don't know everything, and I'm happy to learn. If you know something more than I do, I'd love to learn from you. And so it's a knowledge share. It's about having rational debate. But what we've ended up with is this tribalism. You know, I believe hydrogen is the future. Well, why? Mm. Well, no, I just believe it. And because I believe that, everybody who says not is wrong. No, we need to find a way to be able to have reasoned debate. And this is why your podcast and the stuff that you guys do have the ability to have the debate, right? Bring people on, different views, different perspectives. It stimulates discussion. That's where the real value is. So thank you. I'm very happy to have been invited. Thank you very much for putting me on your podcast. And hey, happy to come back and have a run at this in a deeper dive another time.
Brilliant.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Good stuff.
Okay.
Hey, Graham. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Cheers. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye. Well, thank you once again to Graham for his time and for giving up an evening away from his family to talk to myself and Nick. And we're looking forward to more guests. We're going to have Robert Llewellyn from Fully Charged, the reason I make this podcast. He was the guy that inspired me to go electric many years ago. And I met Robert a few times over the years, various things, and always had fascinating chats, but never really for this long. So the next one next month is going to be a proper sit down with Robert. He's such a good communicator that Robert has a way of just sitting back and letting people talk and getting other people to tell the story. But that's a real skill. So I'm looking forward to being the one that asks the questions and finding out about his motivation for starting and growing and continuing Fully Charged, and a bit more about his personal life, his personal journey in terms of electrifying, and, you know, his hopes and dreams for the future as well. So we'll let you know about date for that one. When it is in the diary. It is in the diary. I've just forgotten. I was trying to style it out. Right, question of the week. I'll read out yours on Sunday 27th. We're going to make it a two-weeker because, like I say, missed the usual cadence of the show. And so we're talking about route planning in EV. How do you route plan all your charge stops if you're going on a journey? Do you just jump in and start driving? Do you pre-plan it for hours in advance? Do you let the car do it, or do you do apps? Let me know. Email hello@evnewsdaily.com. Thanks as always to our Patreon partners, Phil Roberts of Electric Future, Brad Crosby, Porsche of the Village in Cincinnati, Audi of Cincinnati East, Volvo Cars of Cincinnati East, NationalCarCharging.com and AlohaCharge.com, Derek Riley doing his month-long challenge, and also still running his EV Review Ireland YouTube channel, making some brilliant car reviews, proper car reviews, if that makes sense. Hi to Richard at rsev.co.uk, such an easy website to remember, rsev.co.uk, for buying and selling selling EVs in the UK, and Jan at emobilitynorway.com. Have a good and see you tomorrow, and remember, there is no such thing as a self-charging hybrid.